You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Lacrosse Boots. The Lacrosse Alpha Burley Pro delivers an athletic and glove-like fit that will hold the foot in place to prevent chafing and rubbing while on the move. Lacrosse Boots, done right since 1897.
All right, guys, welcome to another Land of Legacy Habitat podcast here on Sportsman's Nation. We've got Matt Dye on the phone calling in from the East Coast.
That's out.
Yeah, you're out. Tell everybody where you're at.
Hi, right now I'm in Virginia. We had a great week. We kind of had to split up in the Midwest. You went further south in the Midwest to do a consultation. I headed east to do a property with a great gentleman and landowner in southeastern Pennsylvania, then hang out with the family for a couple days and then head to Ohio, southeast Ohio, to work a property this coming week. So we've been busy and traveling and touring all over the place.
That's right. And part of that traveling last week was something so exciting for us because we visited with Justin Adams and all the other people at Pure Air Natives. And that's a company we've been working with now for several months and have been working on developing some seed mixes for all you guys, all the listeners, all the properties we reach and with our clients and pretty much anybody who's looking to improve the landscape and improve their land. And this is something that you'll clearly hear it in the interview with Justin, the excitement in our voices when it comes to unveiling the mixes that we've come up with. I think we're just getting started too. And when we talk about, and we don't want to give it all away, but there's really four main mixes that we're talking about, and one of them's an edge mix, and then two phases to prairie bedding, whatever you want to call it, a bedding mix, a prairie mix, a pasture, warm season pasture mix for the guys that are cattle country, and then a screen mix. And these are all designed to improve the habitat, but also be perfect for the role that you're going to plant them in.
And the huntability of farms too. Like, that's the cherry on top.
That's right.
I don't want to give it away, but obviously, again, we are super excited, but you'll hear that.
It's one of my favorite podcasts to date, if not right there. I know it's in the top three.
Which is a powerful statement because there's been, I guess we're
what is this, 76? A little biased.
This is 76, yeah. We're a little biased, but to say that there's been a lot of good ones, but this is definitely up there.
Yeah, because we got to nerd out for a full hour on native grasses and wildflowers, which is something that I think if people understood the power of these native grasses and forbs, one guy commented lately on our Facebook page, Matt, he said, I love how you guys use forage and forbs so much. So I just did it again for him. But the wildflowers, the forbs, basically all that in one word, forb and grasses mix to where we have just an overabundance of food and cover for so many species. And I've asked this question before, but what happens if you walk away from your farm tomorrow or something happens and you leave? What's your legacy? What's the impact that you put on there for better or worse? And this is when you're talking about planting something like native grasses and wildflowers, that's something that can be around a long, long time. So I encourage all of our listeners, if you have the ability or you're interested, do some more research. And when you're ready to go, I promise you, when you see the prices of these things compared to the other ones out there, you're going to be very, very happy.
Yeah. And I think really research and take to heart what is being talked about with the blends and then how they're broken down in a price structure. And then again, how you're implementing that package basically across the entire landscape, because it goes a long ways.
So much. And so we'll let you guys listen to the full interview with Justin, but before we do that, Matt and I were on the QDMA module number 7. We've got one more after this. Once again, if you're interested. I think this is a great value, 20% discount if you go to www.qdma.com/land-and-legacy. It'll take you to these modules, and you can have at it. There's so much information compiled here over an eight-step module course. And this week is whitetail biology, and there's so many interesting tidbits and things that we can use to understand how to become a better land manager and also a better hunter. And I
That's
know
totally
that
right.
we've spent a lot of time talking on the modules in the past. This week we're not going to talk a whole lot on it just because we have so much information coming with the interview with Justin Adams at Pure Air Natives. But Matt.
Real quick, I had a good idea, I think. It's so close to season, and hunters sometimes are tough to buy Christmas presents for. If you want to share the gift of education and knowledge, this is actually a decent gift for someone or a new hunter to get them started and give them a good basis before season starts of why hunters do what they do, and to understand the game that they're chasing. So if you're looking for a gift for someone, maybe it's your dad, you want to help educate, or a landowner, share this with them. Get it out there.
Yeah.
It might be able to help them out and give them a different perspective on things.
The gift of education, that's one thing I used to like, oh, please,
Oh, in college, yeah, for
don't
sure.
bother. Oh,
Yep.
yeah, don't even try to humor me. But now I'm like, I find myself being that person that's got a bookshelf full of books, and I'm like, oh yeah, and you talk a little bit and you say, like Zach Shermer has one of them, one of my favorites from this year's reading. He's got it right now. That's the Journal of Henry Schoolcraft through Southern Missouri, and I just find myself being the guy that says, "Oh, I got a book you need to read." Somebody says, "Don't even humor me," and so, but no, I think that it's a great value, and it's also a great tool to educate yourself and be a better deer manager.
For sure.
So, what were some of your? Do you have any of your favorites?
There were a couple things that stood out to me. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but some of them were the tarsal glands. That's just a creative, like, just very unique part of the whitetail that does so much down the road. We think about it from a hunting standpoint and how it plays and how deer communicate with one another and their uniqueness. There's a lot of information there, including tarsal glands, but that was cool. And then the I think it's the article that Kip talked about sex ratios,
Yeah.
and basically how over time, a lot of the deer kind of auto-correct a little bit, which I don't think is talked about enough. As hunters, we want to make the most conscious effort that we can to take the same number of bucks and does over time. But if you come into a system or an ecosystem and you're extremely skewed, you need to weigh that and do your part to help control it. But know that from this research, this information, this article, that they're going to help auto-correct that or offset that over time as well. So it's not like doom and gloom. It can be corrected, and they're going to help you in that situation almost.
That's right. I think for me, the little graph was just so. He talked about it in the article, but then he gave the graph of kind of breaking it down on there was 90 does and this many bucks, and what happens during hunting season, and then what the ratio would be post hunting, and then what would happen after a bunch of fawns were born, and basically 50-50, half bucks, half does, and then I guess there was mortality outside of hunting season. And then kind of, I mean, nature is one of those things that, to me, it's a darn good thing. It is really good at healing itself without our help because we're terrible at helping it for the most part. As I mean, plowing and all the horrible things we do to our land on a broad scale. It's like, my gosh, it's a good thing it can heal quickly.
We have, like, as a land manager, just like, not even you need to be a manager of the land. You just need to get it back to like the parameters in which it will autocorrect and heal itself.
It's
And
sad
once
to
you do that,
say that sometimes
you're
some of
good.
the best management that a person could do is to stop managing it.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, stop what you're doing.
yeah, maybe let somebody else give it a try.
Yeah.
I think I really enjoyed the one on deer sight and basically how they see, as far as
Yep.
their eyeball, what it does whenever they're looking head up, head down, and how it
Difference
doesn't
in rods and
change, and
cones.
yeah, and then color schemes and what they see and what they don't see. But the UV, talking about how they do see UV better than we do, and how using UV lights or black lights to check your clothes and if they glow. I always think of the video series. I think it was the Dury Outdoors used to use a lot of the infrared cameras, like in the tree stand or in the blind, where it was like green, and some guy would be wearing a top that you couldn't see,
And
and his pants were
yeah.
like glowing. And it's like, man, that right there, that guy needs to use a different detergent or do something to knock that down. So I thought that was really cool. And then there was a part on upper canines, which we get questions on that every single year, throughout the fall. It
Yeah.
seems like somebody kills
You see
one.
those
They think it's the most
photos float through
rare
social
animal
media.
ever.
Yeah.
And one study had 14% of the deer had the upper canines, and then another one was like
Wow.
2%, and another one was 4%. So it varied, but it definitely is a percentage of deer out there that have it. So, but my favorite of this one was the deer sleeping portion, where there's not a lot of research, basically, because they found out
It's
that
tough to get research.
it's tough to research an animal so skittish sleeping. And a lot of times they sleep with their eyes open, and so they interviewed a couple really big guys that have been studying deer for over 100 years together,
Oh, wow.
between the two. And they basically said that if a deer sleeps with his eyes shut, it's less than 5 minutes long in periods. They kind of are fidgety sleepers. They move around a little bit, stand up, stretch, stand up, pee, and do all kinds of stuff.
They're like the old guy in deer hunting camp.
They snore, 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 wake up, and sit there, snore, snore, wake up. And so, they sleep with their eyes open a lot, and they sleep kind of sprawled out or head tucked or head out on the ground. And so that was just really interesting to hear those stories about what they'd seen. So overall, I thought it was a great module. There's a lot of really good information in there. I wish we could have spent more time on it this week,
No doubt.
but we have so much great stuff happening with Pure Air Natives. And so I hope you guys really listen to the entire podcast to hear the pricing and what's specifically in each blend. And then,
And what it's going to achieve for you,
and
each one.
that's right. And I think you need to also, if you're, because we're gearing up, you're buying your seed this fall, you're planting from November to May typically. And I encourage you that when, if you are dead set on using a specific type or whatever, maybe it's not Pure Air Natives. Pure Air Natives, check out the price differences, because I'll promise you, I haven't found it myself of better value out there. So it's definitely something you should check out. So Matt, anything else you want to add to it?
I'm just going to say, you guys go ahead and enjoy and leave us comments and ask us questions about these types of blends. You'll see them incorporated this fall onto some of our film series. But on social media, let us know what you guys are thinking about them. And again, any questions, comment, let us know.
Yep, sounds good. Well, you guys enjoy. Before we get started on this podcast, I want to remind everybody to pay attention to the pricing through the blends, and also note that there is a 10% discount to all listeners and people that follow along, that when you purchase and make your order from Pure Air Natives for these blends, and you mention Land and Legacy, you will get the 10% discount. Also note that although it was not mentioned much in this podcast, Pure Air Natives also has another company called DJM Ecological Services Incorporated, which works a lot on establishing natives, timber stand improvement, prescribed fire, wetland restoration, all kinds of big projects throughout the country. And so if you're interested in tackling one of those big, let's say it's a huge TSI project, it's worth a phone call, because all listeners that mention Land and Legacy get a 15% discount on the work through DJM. So be sure to check that out. Pay attention to the prices, and then I encourage you to compare it to other mixes out there that you may have looked at in the past and thought, oh, wow, I'm not paying for that, because I think this is right in your wheelhouse if you are interested in establishing some natives and the sticker shock got you. I think this is a chance to really get some great blends for a much more affordable price. And I think that all goes with deer hunters establishing this, because we cut out some of the species that are really, really expensive in a native wildflower blends that you often see. So we went with some very affordable species, and so you'll definitely see that when you check out the pricing. So enjoy. All right, welcome to another Land and Legacy podcast. We're going to call it the Habitat Heroes podcast, since it's our habitat focused podcast.
It's the alliteration. Keep up some H's.
And so I'm here myself.
Matt is here.
And then we also have our guest, Justin.
What's going on, Internet?
Yeah, there you go. Justin from Pure Air Natives. And we have spent the last couple of hours up here in St. Louis. Beautiful, beautiful city, north side, right?
Very north side, absolutely.
Strong north side.
And we have been on a couple different properties, a couple different places, going over kind of the native grass wildflower restoration process that Pure Air Natives is all about. And needless to say, you guys thought we nerded out about butterflies and deer and stuff like that, but you really have no idea how much we can nerd out about wildflowers and wild and native grasses, all native, of course. And so today has been a very fun day for Matt and I. We've seen a bunch of different stuff that you guys have had your hands in, but Justin, kind of just give us a background on what you do here at Pure Air Natives.
Well, the most basic thing we do is we sell native grass and wildflower seed. You know, we also have live plugs, as you guys saw from the greenhouses as well. Mm-hmm. But we're really involved in the native prairie restoration, and we sell our seeds through cost share programs with the USDA, NRCS, FSA, MDC, all the different programs out there. And then we also do it on for private lands for folks that are interested in improving their habitat for wildlife or for whatever it is. You know, you like bees, butterflies, birds, deer, turkeys, quail, pheasants, whatever it might be. Natives is the place to, it is the thing to plant for that wildlife.
It's like the foundation for me.
We've done this is 76. Podcast 76. So yeah. By now, hopefully they know that natives is the foundation, hopefully. And this is like the introduction into
diversity.
Diversity
of natives is kind of what it's all about.
Now I know you guys say diversity a lot, and I hear it all the time on the podcast, but we actually have mixes that are called diversity and high diversity and medium diversity mixes and prairie mixes. So as you're going to see, hopefully this afternoon, we're going to go out and see a highly diverse prairie restoration that has 56 species of native forbs in that plantage.
Mm. Wow.
Wow, 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 wow.
Yeah. So. Definitely something I'm excited about. Yeah, no doubt, diversity. I think one time when you think of the food plot world, everybody's like, oh, it's diverse. It's got four species. Yeah. And you're like, four species?
Lame sauce.
And so, and even in the food plot world, like
even in the timbering world, like only people really are focusing on, you know, the enhancement of all these oaks and everything. It takes all kinds of kinds,
yeah,
and in their respective areas to make proper habitat, right?
Absolutely.
But that's where this kind of talk and the natives and kind of comparison to the food plot world, it's apples and oranges.
It really is. There's so much more that you can do in creating a better habitat with natives than you can do with food plots. And not to knock food plots, it's a great supplemental food source.
Absolutely.
But natives can be everything mm-hmm. that food plots can't be.
Well, and they kind of, they check two boxes. And most of the types of plantings, that, and especially some that we're going to talk about today, but it's a cover deal and it's a forage opportunity. And we're always talking about maximizing acres. And if you could have both of those in 1 acre, whereas if you compare that to possibly just a food plot, you just have one of them.
Right.
And, yep. and both are nutritious. Both are attractive. So, you know, we love both, though.
And the key word to that was the native, because when we look at, let's just walk through the process of establishing a food plot. You have a species that's probably not native, so it's not adapted to that soil. And you plant it, you have to, a lot of times, prepare the soil by doing soil tests and trying to get the pH somewhere where that plant would like it. So you may have to add fertilizer, you may have to add lime, you may have to put all that input into it.
You mean add more money to it?
Add more money. Okay. Let's just simple terms. Okay. Add money to it.
Yeah.
And then you plant the species, and if it turns off hot and dry and that species isn't adapted to it, let's say a soybean, since that's one of the most common things. You add all the inputs to it, and then it turns hot and dry, and you have this plant that is starting to wilt. And then you look over, and you see something that's a native that's just like, well, it was made for this.
We covered it last week in the podcast. We were talking about, you know, the timber harvest and then comparing what's growing in there in these tough conditions this summer with the lack of rain, the heat. It's thriving. It's doing great. It's deep-rooted. It's set for this type of climate that we have, whereas – poorly prepared food plots aren't doing well.
That's right.
Yeah, you're essentially what you're doing is you're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. You're trying to take something that's not adapted and force it to work on your piece of property.
That's right. And you're putting a Band-Aid on a big gash that needed a lot of stitches.
Right.
And to me, that's why I get so excited about natives. And then you look at it from the aspect of going, okay, the food plots provide great forage for the deer. Then once it makes pods, it's good for the deer, some birds, turkeys. It's not great structurally for like poults and things like that at a young stage when the turkey poults are small. And then what's it do for the pollinators, the bees and the butterflies? Not a lot.
Relatively nothing.
And so then you look at it and you're like, and then it's not that great. And then you look at a diverse stand of natives and you say, I have something beneficial for almost every native species here when it has the correct amount of diversity.
At some point throughout a year, that those acres in a diverse native setting will be beneficial to wildlife. It's going to achieve something in that life cycle, that stage for tons of species. A diverse amount of wildlife species.
That's right.
Right?
A diverse amount.
Like diverse complements diverse.
Yeah.
Right?
If you planted a whole bunch of soybeans across your entire farm, and then you're like, oh, what happened to the butterflies? Like, why don't I see any more? Well, that's because you have nothing for them.
Right.
And so where's all the honeybees at? I don't ever see honeybees until my soybeans are blooming. Well, that's because that's the only time you have a smidgen of benefit.
It's like where'd all the fish go? Oh, you don't have water.
Yeah. Yeah, where'd all
it's
the
not
ducks,
work.
Where's all the ducks at?
Yeah. Yeah.
You throw in all the other benefits with natives too, the erosion control, the clean water, you know, the pollinator species. Like you said, you bring in the pollinators and it brings in the birds, which brings in the small mammals and other things like that. And all of a sudden you've created this ecosystem with a diverse planting. There's that word again, but you're really doing everything. You're keeping your soil in the field as opposed to disking it and letting it wash off. And you know, year after year after year, little by little, that sediment's getting down into the stream, and now your stuff's washed away. The fertilizer that goes with it, everything else. So
the soil's not nearly as productive as it once was. And then you think about that from a generational standpoint. That's what I try to, as our listeners probably know, what my wife and I are expecting our first shot, and I'm just sitting here going, you know, if I did the same stuff I was doing back when I was in my teenage years at planting food plots and in 10 years of doing that, I noticed a huge decrease in the food plots. You put that on a large scale of production farming, of doing those same techniques, it's like, man, my kid or my kids wouldn't have much to farm. It would just be so degraded after that. And so adding these diverse mixtures and allowing that soil to be built back up and healthy. I love the name, Pure Air. Like, that's just so catchy, you know?
It's timeless. It goes back to, like, that diversity of what you're talking about. It's kind of cleaning, filtering the whole ecosystem. And it just gets things back into rhythm and to gear when you have the ability to offer so much to so many different types of species.
Yeah.
I love it. Absolutely yeah. love it.
No doubt. We could go on and on and
we
on.
We could.
I mean, this is one thing. You guys only think I nerd out about ragweed and then my hatred towards cedar tree monocultures, but don't even get me started on native grasses and wildflowers.
Well, actually, we need to get started. That's what this podcast is about.
Okay.
you're in luck.
Oh, sweet. We have a whole hour to talk about this.
That's right. That's right.
To me, this is just one of those things. So before we really, as Matt likes to say, dive on in. Justin, give us a little bit of your background on Pure Air. How long you've been here and kind of what your role is here.
So I'm the marketing manager here at Pure Air. I have been working here since the beginning of 2018. A little bit about why I'm here is Pure Air, prior to me getting here, did a lot of work with landowners through cost share programs. But with my background and knowing about, I'm also the president of a QDMA branch here in St. Louis. I know you guys run your branch too. So, you know, QDMA club right here.
Woo woo.
But, so knowing that I was trying to create better habitat for my for the hunting purposes at my property, I really got into natives, and especially because I don't have the big tractors and the big equipment to do a lot of food plot stuff. So I'm looking at ways that I can do this from a more realistic standpoint, that's something that's going to be beneficial. So I really started diving into natives and learning as much as I could, and really fell in love with what Pure Air is doing and what the direction they want to go with bringing the native planting into wildlife more for the hunters and the landowners out there, as opposed to just the guys that are running through the cost share programs.
Yeah.
So, and I'm here to do that. I can talk about wildlife and deer hunting and planting for wildlife all day long, every day. And I love it.
That's right.
It's fantastic.
It's always very, I appreciate it when you meet somebody who gets to do their passion as a job, because that's what we get to do. We get to do our passion as a job. You're the same way. And you just think about, we haven't said it yet, or I kind of touched on it, the generational mindset of natives. It's something that gets planted. When you plant a native, like native grass, wild, a prairie restoration, you plant something under the proper care at the beginning. You plant something that could be there for a long, long time after you, as long as somebody didn't come in and plow it under.
History proved that it was a sustainable ecosystem until we came and destroyed it. But we can do what Pure Air Natives does, and we can restore it and then bring it back and have years and years and years and years of incredible habitat.
The great thing about a prairie restoration, or, you know, natives for wildlife, it's kind of one and the same there. But the great thing about it is you don't necessarily have to have heavy equipment to do that. You don't have to disc the ground. There's ways to plant. These seeds are so native seeds are so microscopic, so tiny, that as long as you can get that seed to touch the soil, you're going to get some growth out of that. And then the way you maintain that over time is through fire or through mowing. Everybody's got a lawnmower, right? You know, yep. You can pick up a riding lawnmower fairly cheap and cover a couple of acres, no problem. So you can maintain that and develop your prairie without needing heavy equipment to do that. In a lot of cases, you can go out and clear some ground through herbicide and then come through with a fire, and you can get natives, depending on what's been there in the past and what's been planted.
Sure.
You can get a percentage of natives to grow back, and
totally.
You can start from there and continue maintaining that.
Add
without the need for
needed.
A $50,000 tractor, you know, a $15,000 drill. All those things don't have to play into creating some of the best habitat there is for wildlife.
Which is funny, because, like, as we'll talk about, you know, some of the forbs that are in here are, like, extremely showy and beautiful to just look at. And it's like, why do we get away from that, where we took something that's not native and put it into our environment and said, oh, that's pretty. And but we took away the very thing that's like, oh my gosh, that's breath, like, takes your breath away, honestly. And that, like I said, we'll discuss some of them, but the flowering is like,
it's almost
throughout,
like,
this whole summer too.
You want to say, listen up, fellas, landowners, hunters, that your wife, you're trying to find a way to get your wife on the farm. Listen up, because native,
crank that radio,
native
right
wildflowers is a possible way to do that. When you tell her the impact you're making by planting native grasses and wildflowers and what that's doing for the soil and the water quality and the insects. And you tell her the big picture of how beneficial it is to the whole system. Now, the smidgen part of that is it makes your honey better. But you tell her all that, and she goes, well, that's really cool. I want to see that. And
she's, then you get, say, why didn't you do this first?
Yeah.
Right.
Hopefully, right? Because, yeah. I mean, it's logical. In the long run, it really is logical.
Yeah. It's one of those things that you just – it's big picture mindset.
It's long term. For sure. So, for sure.
Yeah.
Which I think is why sometimes that it does. I think that's that kind of caveat to the question posed earlier. It's like, why don't we do it? Well, I think because it's a longer term – mindset, and not that it doesn't take, you can't have success year one with it, but it takes some time to see the longer term benefits. But my gosh, we're so like just driven to
immediate gratification.
Immediate gratification.
You can
on everything
it,
we do.
You can equate it to planting trees, right? I mean, yep. That's going to be a long term. You know, you're dedicating some time, some commitment to that tree to get it to maturity for whatever kind of mast or whatever it might be, mm-hmm. for any type of tree planting. So, you know, a native species, generally speaking, is going to take a few years before it's mature. So yeah. You may not get flowers year one. And when somebody sees 3 foot tall, quote unquote, weeds growing yeah. out in a field, they mow it down. It doesn't look pretty, you know?
Yeah.
And then these flowers, when they do bloom, may only bloom for 2 months out of the year. You know, that may happen in early spring, and then they don't bloom again until next year. So it could very well depend on the time of the year somebody visits that particular plot. They may never see a flower on it at all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, they've missed
it.
So, there's a lot of things that kind of factor into potentially why we've gotten away from that. You know, America's love affair with turf grass has been ongoing for years and years, and that's kind of choked some things out. But there is with natives, there's a commitment level that you have to be willing to put into before you see those results, and that's generally going to be a few years before you see the picturesque magazine cover type, you know, prairies that you're looking for.
I can't remember. It might have been Doug that called it the blue stem blues. Whenever you plant blue mm-hmm. stem, and it's like, you think, I mean, you go out and you throw ryegrass or tall fescue and on the ground, and
yeah.
in 6 months it's growing up, and you can send
cutting grass.
Yeah, yeah, you're cutting crazy. Grass, you send the cows in there. With blue stem, it's a little bit, it can be difficult to get it to the 6 foot tall that you expect mm-hmm. in the first year. And people get frustrated with that, and they give up on it.
But to combat that, it's a mindset that you have to know how to manage it and what to expect. When you start, when you make that commitment to do this kind of stuff, how do I need to, or what should I be expecting this month, or this year? And if you have that, all is well.
Yeah.
One other thing I'll say with that too is not to go too far down the rabbit hole and get too nerdy here, but the stratification of seed is extremely important, and knowing that your seeds have been stratified. The stratification process is what allows the seed to actually germinate. So native species have a much different stratification process than your typical, row crops that you're going to throw out there. And some of those species, if they're not stratified, they won't germinate that year that you put them out there. They might take a full calendar year before they get that stratification needed mm-hmm. in order to germinate. So the blue stem, the big blue stem blues, the blue stem blues where, you know, what's going on here? I planted this seed. Why isn't it growing? Well, if it wasn't stratified properly, then it's going to take another year for that, you know, those climactic changes and the atmosphere, the moisture, the cold temps, the everything else that factors into that to germinate that seed.
Yeah. Great, great explanation.
Yeah. Perfect. Yep. Perfect.
You said not to nerd out too much.
It's fine. You're welcome here. You're welcome at this table.
Yeah, well, we nerd out every single week, probably.
Well, I'm trying to think about the listener driving down the highway going, yeah. What did he just say? Hold on. Hold on. I got to pull
Stratus?
Over.
Mm-hmm.
Did he say strat and seed?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, so to me, that you know, this morning, a great comparison or a great story to tell is, you know, when you drive across the landscape and – try not to throw up too much over what all's happened to our land. To me, I'm going to go off on some I'll just warn you. Here's I'm going to go on rabbit trails like crazy on this podcast.
I can hear the beagles coming.
That's great. Yeah, so you drive across the landscape and you see nothing but, I mean,
cedars
and Cerisa lespediza, teasel, Johnson grass. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And how many people, if we polled hunters and we said, do you love the land that you're hunting on? And they would all, almost 99% of them would say, heck yes, I love it. I love it.
Why not? Yeah.
And then you say, okay, if you love it, like, why do you let it deteriorate like this?
It's no different from, like,
there's stuff growing.
A dirty house. You can have a house and you can live in it, but if it's dirty and nasty, whatever, it's going to slowly degrade and get worse and worse and worse and not produce what you want.
That's
right. But why live in that condition, not maintain it as such and take pride in that ownership of the house? Ownership of the land is no different.
So if you truly loved it, wouldn't you want to know? To me, is going, I want to know what was there before it got screwed up. And
in some cases, it's, I want to know if it's screwed up.
Yeah. And so then it's like, okay, if you're in Ohio, Alabama, Florida, wherever you're at, Michigan, Missouri, I think it should be our duty to understand what that landscape. Now, I'm asking a lot out of everybody, but it should be, I want to know what's native to this site. And it's not hard to find.
It's not.
You can get and do some work and find the native landscape. And a lot of times you're going to find the stuff that we're talking about here, native grasses, native wildflowers, almost all the time, actually. And you're going to look at that and say, okay, how do I get that back? Is that here or do I need to plant it?
Or am I too far removed? And that you brought it up earlier. Sometimes you can do that in some sites that haven't been too far removed from this native habitat that was originally there. You can do some work. We've talked about it, spraying out cool season grasses and having that seed bank regenerate. But in other cases where it's been so far removed, or the farmers come in and destroyed or ruined that seed bank, you have to then go in and plant it. That's why we're here today, to talk about it, talk about the benefits of it, and then basically those situations that you need to plant and what it is to plant.
Yeah, it's in today's habitat out there, it's pretty rare to be able to start with nothing, go out and you know, spray out or burn out or whatever your cool season grasses, and then to get a high percentage of natives to grow back in that place. It's pretty rare. It can be done. It happens. But usually you're going to be in the less than 20% natives coming back, you know, on a little bit better preparation and sites, you can maybe get up to 40% or so, but there's still going to be a lot that you're going to be fighting, but it can be done.
Yeah.
And I think part of that stems in knowledge, right? You need to know it's plant ID. Mm-hmm. You know, we know what soybeans look like. We know what corn looks like. We've seen that all our lives growing up. It's everywhere. But does anybody know what Illinois bundleflower looks like? Can anybody identify the partridge pea that we saw this morning that was, you know, 8 inches tall?
Yep.
The milkweeds.
Exactly. You know, and especially before they bloom, these species that are growing that are foot or two tall, you know, it can be difficult to identify that.
Sure can.
But if you start with three or four, if you're out at your property and you see something, you don't know what it is, even if you don't have a cell phone signal, you can take a picture of that and go back and look it up later. You know, but we've got apps. If you've got the ability to open the app, take the picture, identify it right there where you're standing.
Yeah.
But start with two or three or four that you see a lot of out there and start making. You don't have to go out and do this entire thing in one season or one year or even one weekend.
Pick
just make an effort.
Five species a month. At the end of the year, you got 60 species that you know and can identify.
Good math, Matt.
Thank you.
I was going to break out the calculator.
That's right. We're 23 minutes into this. If people are like, man, these guys are going to ramble on about native, stick with us, because later on we're going to discuss the blends that we have worked with Pure Air to come up with that anybody can plant and have huge benefits on their place with, whether it's 20 acres or 5,000 acres. call us. We'd be glad to hunt with you on that 5,000 acres. Yeah. But so stick with us. We are getting to something that you want to hear.
Yeah, this, the preliminary, the build up.
Yeah, there should be some major excitement
this
in
is like
our
the,
voice
the hype
because
moment, right?
We have some stuff coming with Pure Air that I think is very exciting when you compare to other things that are offered in the industry and what can benefit you specifically on your place. So what I was going to say on that when I went off on my rabbit trail was let's use the example from this morning and after you drive down the highway and you see all the non-natives taking over the roadside, then you drive into landscape or into your suburb and into your housing development or whatever, and you look at the landscape and you look at the landscaping plants. And most of them are ornamentals or non-natives, and you're like, oh, doggone it. Like
exotic.
Exotic.
Some of them are very exotic.
Yeah. Today we were driving in that new, like where they built up the median and planted all this stuff. It was, what did I say it was?
Travel too many miles. I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. Reed's canary grass.
Oh, yeah.
All
that
clumped up. Yeah.
Roundabout.
And, there was a lot of like other ornamental species there, and it's like, you know what, it's going to take a lot of these species. You see them drying up during the winter. I'm fighting it in the house that we bought had a bush that's non-native, and it cannot take the heat at all. So it's like constantly trying to water it just to keep it alive.
Sure.
So I don't have to hear my wife say, I can't believe you let that bush die.
Sure.
And then you look at the natives, and you're just like, they're thriving in this stuff.
They are.
It's and we stepped out of the
maintenance.
The first place that we stopped, we stepped off the porch and saw butterfly milkweed planted in his landscape, and there was four monarch caterpillars right there.
Yeah.
And it's just like,
right there at the house.
I mean, right there at the house.
And we weren't stepping out on a farmhouse where we were out in a field. This was mulch, manicured.
This
landscaping
is
done
anybody's
around,
house.
Right. This was done right around the house, landscaping to make it look nice, but had some butterfly milkweed grown right there. And like you said, we had what, four caterpillars
four.
Right there within a 3 foot, maybe 2 foot area.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And probably there because it's no one else has it. But regardless, it just shows and proves that, listen, you can have natives, you can plant them in a landscape setting and they're pretty, they have their function. But it's not as much maintenance either because they're suited and adapted.
Yeah, and going back to that question you ask all these hunters, do you love land? They'll say yes. Well, talk is cheap. Let's prove it now that we love it, and let's start trying to plant stuff that is beneficial to all of our native species.
It's their tagline, plant your legacy.
That's it.
That's it. You know, we talk about, you know, how they thrive in drought conditions and in these types of, you know, you get into late summer. I mean, how many areas in the country right now are struggling because of
tons,
no rainfall?
Tons.
And these species have been adapted thousands and thousands and thousands of years. They have, most natives now have a root system that is so complex and so deep that turf grass and most annual row crop plantings can't even compete with that. These native plants, the root system and the root wad, I guess, if you will, you know, is can be down 6, 8, 10, 12, some of them 15 and 16 feet deep. They're going to find water. There's no doubt about it. They will find water that the surface of the, you know, the soil up top has dried out days and days ago.
Yep.
But 10, 8, 6 feet deep, there's moisture down there, and those plants are thriving because of that.
That's right. You've got that picture you have at your booth that I just I still
think
about.
Yeah, at NWTF when you guys just stopped and you know, staring at the root system on that, and then to see, you know, turf grass over on the side with a 6-inch or 8-inch root system.
I bet your listeners were like, you know, they had the what was that famous picture that's always in the movies or the posters, like Farrah Fawcett or something like that, like on the wall.
Yeah,
like, we grew up with that poster on our wall, looking at the root
system.
Laid in bed
my
at
kid
night.
Will.
Oh, look at the root system.
Yeah, that's right. Look at the difference. Yeah. Compass plant has like one of the deepest ones that I know of. That's like could be 16 foot deep, and it's just like,
And it's doing so well right now, showy flower that puts on, you know, a beautiful bloom, attracts, as you saw this morning,
tons
of pollinators. I mean, bees were everywhere across some of that stuff we were looking at. Butterflies flying around, birds eating every insect they could get their beaks on.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just, it was literally buzzing with activity there that, you know, you wouldn't find out in a fescue field or you know, out in a cedar monoculture. You don't see that.
Yep. Yeah, and then, so for the cattle guys, or the guys that are listening that have cattle farms that are trying to manage their properties for both the wildlife and the cows, when you talk about the benefits of the native grass and wildflowers for the wildlife, then you will briefly touch on it because this is a hunting and habitat focused podcast, but talk about the benefits of native grasses and wildflowers to cows and how they can fill that void of the summertime blues that cattle farmers face when they are planting and grazing these cool season perennial pastures, the tall fescue, orchard grass, even the red clovers mixed in, that all kind of shut down during the summer months in the heat especially. And then you look at the native grasses that were thriving, and you want to talk about some gains during the summer months when normally if you're your conventional farmer looking at these perennial cool season grass pastures, and during the summer months, you just try to level off. And you're just like, I hope they can just keep their
maintain,
weight.
Right.
We just want to maintain. And then you look at native grasses, and you sent the info to me of the guy that had almost three-pound gains.
Right. With natives, month after month. On, you know, he wasn't just, say, sustaining. He was growing. He was putting on
weight. And you
just can't do that with these cool season grasses, especially that time of year.
Yes.
You know, there's no other way to do that, to have gains, and those are massive gains for cattle.
Those are huge gains.
Yes. I mean,
that's money made right there. But what gets me is just the logicalness of, or the lack of it, I guess, is let's graze cool season grasses during the summertime.
Yes.
During the warm season.
Why? Let's plant non-native perennial cool season grasses in a yard and then gripe when it's trying to dry up during the summer months and you're out there watering it like crazy.
I got to water this. Well, yeah. Like,
trying to psych out the grass thinking it's still a cool season and it's supposed to continue growing. It doesn't make sense.
Don't work like that.
We use a lot of time and resources, generally speaking, we use a lot of time and resources trying to keep non-native and cool season and all these things that shouldn't be there growing and shouldn't be doing what they're doing, just to keep them alive, just to keep them sustained and maintained.
Yes.
We put a lot of time, effort, and money into that.
I laugh when I see people talk about trying to plant like a glade. There's glades across the country, but where we're at, there's a lot more of them, the Ozark glades. And you have these areas, for the people that don't know, very shallow soil, very dry, almost desert-like grasslands. And native speaking, it's got little blue Indian grass, big blue, some switch grasses there. Also has tons of coneflowers and all kinds of other wildflowers. And they just grow naturally. They thrive on it. But then we go in and we try to, like, we buy that piece of ground cheap. And we're like, I'm going to plant a food plot here.
Well, because it's already typically semi-open.
Semi-open.
So it's like, well, I don't have to clear it. I don't have to cut it. I don't have to doze it. Let me just plant it.
I'm going to plant, and you'll plant, like, let's just say it's a cattle farmer or a food plotter, and they're going to plant a non-native that's not adapted to that site and plant it and go, doggone it, I got to pump the fertilizer into that just to get it to grow. And it's like, why?
Just stop.
Why?
Just rethink it. Go back. Start over. Stop.
That's it. And so we could go on and on. But all right,
we've got some exciting stuff to talk about.
Yeah, let's go ahead and start talking about it.
And I want to, before we really get into it, we're going to talk about these different blends that we've worked with Pure Air to create and put together throughout the summer time frame, and basically had, you know, goals and objectives that, okay, we want this mixture, this blend to do this, and this to do this, and this type of situation. One of those is going to be developing edge habitat, or edge species, for hunting strategies and for overall food plot strategies.
The edge.
And before we say that, let's say the obvious. Let's talk about the elephant in the room when it comes to native wildflowers and grasses. The sticker price is always the thing that people kind of steer away from, because you look at it and it's a lot of times you'll see it, the prices, it's $50 to $150 per pound. and you're like, per pound, I'm usually planting
per pound.
I'm planting 50 pounds of wheat for 1 acre, and how is it per pound? And so you're like, man, that's just crazy to me to think about planting a species that's not, you think that, oh, well, that wildflower is not even as, the deer aren't going to eat that like they eat a soybean. I'm much better off to plant a soybean. But you get it one year with the soybean.
Yep.
Maybe, if the deer don't eat it at a young age and you get enough rain. Now, when it comes to the natives, is you plant that, and if it gets established, you have that for years and years.
Self-regenerating. Well,
that's
right. With the proper management and upkeep.
And that's a good point you bring up, Adam, about the cost, because they are, especially when you get into this food plot and hunting industry, it's sticker shock, right? You see these prices on some of these things, and you said $50 a pound. There are some species that are $900 a pound. There are some species even higher than that.
Oh, no, the listeners just stopped listening. I'm kidding.
Right. But as you guys saw this morning, first off, the harvesting on our production plots, the harvest of these seeds is a thankless job. It is painstaking.
Right.
And mostly because these seeds are microscopic. And I mean that.
That's not figurative.
No, I'm looking at it right here. You know, the Plains Coreopsis has got over 200,000 seeds, 200,000 per ounce. Can you imagine having an ounce of seed in your hand?
I think we look at
and
like
sneeze.
Soybeans,
it's
like,
gone.
Yeah, I plant about 150,000 seeds per acre.
Right.
Yeah.
That's in comparison to this?
Right.
Right.
An ounce has over 200,000 seeds. I mean, there's thousands upon, you know, Black Eyed Susan's got almost 100,000 seeds in it per ounce. So you're talking about, you don't have to buy a pound of seed to plant something, especially in all our cost share mixes. You know, they're putting together right now everything you plant, like the monarch species. The monarch mix is a big one right now. It's a minimum of 20 species, right? That mix, when it's said and done, is only going to be 4 or 5 pounds total. You know, it's going to have a couple of ounces of this and 3 ounces of that and, you know, maybe a pound of grasses total in that mix. And then it's going to have, you know, ounces of forbs in it. So when you hear that price, there's a lot of factors that go into that. It's the harvesting, the collecting, the amount of seed that you actually need to plant is very minuscule. You know, we send out bags of 4 pounds for an acre, and somebody calls us and says, "Where's the rest of it?" No, that's trust me, that's all you need. That's more than enough for what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know. So, and then on top of that is, natives aren't grown like soybeans are grown or corn are grown. You can't go to every corner, you know, every
co-op
and buy those natives and just pick them up anywhere. You're not going to go to your big box store and pick up seed packs full of natives. You're going to get, you know, all the other stuff, the more ornamental and exotic and non-native stuff in a seed pack that people want to see. But these natives aren't sold like that. They're not collected and harvested. And so that factors into the price on some of this stuff. But we've put together, with your guys' help, put together some excellent packages for, you know, guys to get started.
Very cost effective, too.
Yeah, and hunters and land managers, like, it serves a purpose for us.
Yes.
Like, what we do on a daily basis. So I want to say real quick, before we get into talking about the mixtures itself, we have done a portion of a podcast number 62 on edge habitat and edge species and developing edges throughout a property. And some of what we're going to talk about is going to be included in there, and you can go back and reference that podcast in association with these blends or one of the blends that we're going to talk about.
And I think this edge blend that you kind of touched on just a second ago, when we think about a food plot, think of how many times you see it. You have 70 to 100-foot tall trees straight down to a food plot, and they plant right up to the trunk of those trees.
As close as you can get. More food.
And then you sit there and you watch the center of the food plot do really well, but the edge just is terrible.
Crummy.
And especially in the fall crops.
Yeah.
And you're like, why is it like the trees? It's under the drip line. They're competing with the trees, but I'm still going to plant it because maybe there's a chance I can put enough fertilizer on it to do well.
Coach it along.
Why do we do that? That's just a waste of money every single year to fertilize, to put the seed down, and it provides very little benefit to the wildlife. So how can we improve
that? They bypass it because it's not even the most nutritious and go to the center of the field.
It's the opposite of the edge effect, where we don't – deer are often called creatures of the edge, but it's not because they prefer the edge and that's where they make their living. It's because there's a lot of species that aren't necessarily throughout the landscape.
The rest of it.
Like when you look at the amount of sunlight that hits the edge of a food plot from coming in from the side – there's a lot of young forest. There's a lot of regen plants. There's a lot of early successional plants. And then you move 50 yards into the timber, and you don't have that. And it's because it's too much shade. And so we can design something and come up with something. I guess we didn't design it. God designed it. But we came up with the idea to try to plant other species that are going to do much better than your fall plots.
Well, the reason us food plotters, we want to plant up to the edge, or in theory, the whole point of that is to maximize your space, right? There's no trees growing there, so I need to plant something there. They want as much as they can get for it. Well, this edge feather, these natives are going to maximize that because you're clearly not doing it with your soybeans right up against the tree line, under the drip line, you know.
Yeah.
You can see it. What's neat is I've been to some properties recently where they've got a massive couple of trees growing, and they don't have a very defined tree line. So you can see the circle of the drip line into it. It's not just one long wood line like you would normally see along a field edge, but instead you see it's almost like the shadow of the tree, but it's not a sunlight issue. It's the drip line. It's the resources that it's competing for.
Yes.
And that's really easy to point out and see that you've got 3 foot tall soybeans out here and you've got a foot tall soybeans or foot and a half tall soybeans
and
underneath
they're all
that drip
wilted.
Line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Exposed soil. You know, it's going to be much hotter there than it is out there in the field. So
why are natives going to do better? Deeper root systems. Better adapted to growing in shade and sun.
Especially these species that have been selected for this edge mix.
Yes. And so, to me, this is what, out of all the blends, this is one I'm very excited about. Because when you look at the price, oh my gosh, it's you're in savings in fertilizer and food plot seed in 1 year. You're probably going to pay for this because it's not going to require acres and acres and acres. It's really going to require just buying the seed, planting 5, 10, maybe 15 feet out around the edge of the food plot.
Yeah, for sure. And because of this blend, we're not only creating, I guess, a cost savings from a food plot standpoint, but we're creating different types of habitat for broods, turkey broods, for poults, for, which is the same thing, for fawns, for quail, for
rabbits, rats, mice,
everything.
All the things going to all the podcasts we're talking about small games.
We're bringing forbs into this mixture so it attracts the insects, which bring in, like I said, the turkeys, everything. So it has its purpose beyond just the food plot. Oh, we're going to save your time and do this. Like it's meant to be here like this.
Absolutely.
That's right.
And you get in, you can take it one step further. And I know this is a dangerous topic to touch on, but you're creating fawning habitat to protect those fawns from those coyotes out there.
That's right.
And without doing that, those food plots aren't doing that. You have your soybeans growing from May, June through the harvest season. And when those leaves drop, there's no cover in there. There's nothing there to hide those, you know, fawns who are still susceptible, you know, that year's fawns to predation on from coyotes.
That's a great point, too, because I laugh when people talk about how you don't want to have the narrow strips for fawns or turkey poults because predators can just run those strips, but then you let the habitat just go terrible everywhere, and it's like, well, at least there's a better chance they survive. Right. Now, and if you do that across the landscape, holy cow, you've created some great habitat that's really going to leave a lasting effect.
And it's simple. It just around the field edges, another field, do it again.
And don't spray it like you spray every year. You just let it do its thing. And to me, the other, why do you want to plant this? Well, we all love deer moving during daylight. And deer move during daylight when they're comfortable to move during daylight. How do you make a deer comfortable? Bingo. You give them the habitat that they need to feel comfortable. You give them
the cover and the structure
to where they feel like they can move and not be seen.
If you're a deer hunter listening to this podcast and you take nothing from this podcast except for this right here, planting natives, especially this edge mix, planting species like this is going to increase deer movement during daylight on your property more than anything you could ever do to your property.
Yeah.
I'd say period at the end, but it's actually more of like an exclamation point at the end of that.
It is. You will increase movement so much more. You will see so much more activity on your property by creating this type of habitat than by anything else.
That's right.
For sure.
And to me, it's just, it's something that I don't know why we haven't done it yet. It's like, this should have been planted. You know, people make the statement, should have been planted yesterday. Mm-hmm. Well, it should have been planted last year. Actually, let's go back. It should have never been removed.
There we go. There we go.
And so, to me, that's one thing. We want to talk about deer moving during daylight. Let's plant the edge. Let's give them something tall that they feel comfortable. Not only that, there are species in here that are going to provide great forage during the growing season. Then it's going to mature, and it's going to provide great structure. There's great food in here for birds like quail and turkey poults with the partridge pea and Illinois bundleflower. Then you have the coreopsis and the coneflowers, and I'll let you list it out. But there's so many benefits with this that it's just, if you haven't bought the seed yet and planted it, then by golly, let's sign up. That's what I got to say, because it's just one of those things. It's like, man, this is so awesome.
Well,
great for erosion control and food plots if you don't have the rocks like we do. You need something to – you're like, man, I plow and I disc and I do all that, and then we get a big rain and a lot of my soil runs off to the edge. Well, there's been proven research that shows that these big – diverse mixes, buffer strips, I think they call
buffer
them, on crop fields helps with the water quality and erosion control. Well, now you're doing it in a smaller scale on your food plots.
Right.
And all similar studies of that have shown the increase in yields adjacent to those buffer strips.
That's
And the crop production in that area because of pollinators that are attracted to this.
Yeah, the buffer strip is an actual program, a cost-share program that you can come in and put in where they go through. We do the exact same thing, but now we're taking that, and it's noted that this is better habitat for wildlife, but it's not new. It's just new for the hunters. Natives aren't planted in the hunting industry very often, but everybody else is doing it to keep the habitat and keep everything in place and the clean water and clean air and pollinators and everything else. Let's bring that over to the hunting world and create that better habitat.
That's it.
For these animals.
Oh, we're bringing it.
That's right. So we have it. In the as edge mix, we have little blue stem, Indian grass, big blue stem, switchgrass. Those are our big main grasses in that one. We have black-eyed Susan, false sunflower, purple prairie clover, one of my favorites, partridge pea, and Illinois bundleflower. All two of those three right there are some of my top, probably in my top five altogether. Plains coreopsis and upright prairie coneflower.
And if you don't know what that is, don't be afraid, because it takes time to learn what these species are. But we're going to list them out and have them in the show notes, but research them. Go look and see what they're going to look like in the long run once they're established.
That's right. And then it's sold in just over 8 pounds an acre. And the value of that is $120 per acre.
And you're like, well, okay, I'm paying eight pounds per acre, 120. That's a lot per pound. But let's break it down like this. If you do a 5 foot yard wide strip.
Did you hear that?
Five foot yard.
Did I say that?
Five foot yard.
Which one do you want to go with?
What unit of measurement is that?
It's actually
we're
going to
need
Virginia.
A calculator for that.
Five foot.
That's the scientific calculator.
That's the second time I've done that. Yeah, it takes some fancy maneuvering on a calculator to figure that out.
/.
Yeah.
Y.
You throw the variables in there. Okay. It is a 5 yard wide strip that will cover 968 yard field perimeter.
So for us, to keep that simple for you, we have three new food plots that are roughly anywhere from an acre and a half.
Well, they've seen them in the films.
To two, The ones we use, permanent forest openings. We planted the whole thing of soybeans this year to kind of control some of the weeds, and we had Cerisa lespides and Johnson grass coming up, so we've been spraying it out, trying to kill those species, making sure we have it under control. But the 5 yard strip all the way around these three food plots, which are anywhere from an acre and a half to 2 acres, all three of those add up to almost that. So we're buying 1 acre worth to plant these three food plots.
It's
for 5 yard wide.
It's 5+ acres of food plots.
Yeah, almost six.
Almost 6 acres of food plots that with one, or yeah, one bag or this 8 pounds, $120 per acre. That's what we're planning, covering that much ground. That's a lot.
So it wouldn't take a lot of the edge blend to improve your farm and make deer more comfortable.
If you don't have that many acres of food plots or field edge, split it with a neighbor. Find someone in a deer co-op. Say, hey, listen, I want this on my property, but I can't use all this seed.
Plant the whole field.
To me, you know, that's where, like,
or make the strip wider.
Right. We have a bedding blend and kind of this idea, but shoot, you could plant the whole field in that and have a great, I mean,
well,
so many benefits to wildlife.
60% of this blend right here is under 3 foot tall. So when a deer beds down, lays down, he's gone.
Yeah.
You can't see him in this.
And to me, it goes with the whole, diversity. Like, switchgrass and big blue stem and all that's great for cover, but there's not hardly any beneficial forage wide.
Correct. That's what we see in the typical CRP.
And then if you plant straight monoculture of it, it can get so thick the deer don't want to even walk through it. So this diversity of bunch grass and forbs and broadleaves all mixed together is ideal for all the wildlife. So let's create that, and that's why we have so much diversity in that mix. The next one, we have the trail screen. How many people, deer hunters, have planted a screen to try and hide them? I mean, it's so new this year.
Better question. How many people plant one every year?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How many people plant one?
In the same spot.
Every year that really provides nothing other than screening.
Especially after the first frost.
And so this is where ours is a little different, because it's like, it goes back to that managing every acre, every foot for the wildlife. Why not plant something that's also benefiting the wildlife? May not be the white-tailed deer specifically, but you should still, I hope you're still concerned about some of the native species there, as the rabbit, quail, another songbirds, whatever it is. And so you plant it, and you're trying to just plant it every year, and it blows over, and you're like, oh, man, that really didn't work when I needed it. But adding the diversity and adding some broadleaves in there to where they're structured, to where it can stand up during the winter months. So we have wild golden glow, false sunflower, big blue stem, switchgrass. That's the one you see so much. Illinois bundleflower and partridge pea. And people are going, what in the heck is Illinois bundleflower and partridge pea doing in there?
Well, and then they're looking up.
That's a foot
saying,
tall.
Yeah, why? And I have that in a screen. Are you kidding me? Why'd they put that in there?
Yeah. Well, it's grown waist tall, and it looks like it's got soybean pods all mangled together.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about the Illinois bundleflower. That's because it's providing food for a lot of your other species. You're having more rabbits, you're having more quail, you're having more songbirds, whatever it is. We're just about improving the landscape for all the native species. So that's why we add this other stuff in.
And having those legumes into the grasses is the diversity, and that's how it naturally grew. So let's put it back in there.
You know, part of this too is with the different species and the different heights, you're going to create something that's going to stand up and stay standing up. And because these are perennials, they're going to be back year after year. You're looking at, planting it once and it's going to stand up, where you get into some of the switchgrasses and some of the other things and you plant that monoculture, it doesn't have the strength in the understory of that planting to stay up it may droop, it may sag, you get snowfall, which, we didn't have much of this year, but in certain areas of the country, you get a foot of snow or 2 foot of snow and that stays down and it's never back. So, there's strength in having those shorter species in there.
And if I'm reading this correctly, switchgrass is the dominant species in this mix.
Right.
So that's the one that everybody wants to plant. So you still have the dominant switchgrass, but we've mixed in other species to really benefit the wildlife. And if we're really talking about it, fine-tuning it, we have legumes in here which are going to fixate nitrogen, which are feeding our grasses.
Yes.
So,
and you touched on it a minute ago too, but you get into the monoculture of switchgrass, and over time, that's going to thicken up. And a lot of people don't know that. And switchgrass is a great in the hunting industry right now. Switchgrass is the grass. You know, it's
the hinge cutting of grass.
Really, I hadn't heard.
Exactly. So, and people want to buy that and buy that and plant as a monoculture, but your deer are going to avoid that as it thickens up. You know, the first couple of years you'll be fine, but as it recedes and as it grows stronger and thicker, it's going to be something that they can't get through. They don't – deer like to feel safe, but they don't want to be in the thickest –
constrained.
You know, right, exactly.
They need a point of exit.
They need to escape. Kind of be able to see, smell, hear mm-hmm. what's coming, but have medium. The ability to escape easily. Right.
And a real thick stand of switchgrass that's
not
you know,
that
five,
conducive.
6, 8 years old, that's just going to get avoided. There may be one trail that goes through there, but that's it.
Yeah, that's right. So, man, oh, man, I'm excited about that one. So then we go into another blend, which is called the Prairie Blend or Bedding Blend, whatever you want to call it. We look at it because it's a kind of the step process of restoring a prairie setting.
Well, and I think this, we talked about it earlier about, you know, why we've gotten away from it a little bit, and that's sometimes the maintenance that it takes or the process that it takes to establish. And this one goes into a little bit more detail of what it takes to get this blend up and going for the long-term benefit of it. We did a lot of research and a lot of talking with people who are planting and establishing diverse stands of basically a prairie blend just like this and said, what do you guys recommend? What again, what's the phases or do we do this all at once?
What's the quickest way to get an established
and
prairie?
Best way.
Yes.
Yep.
We didn't say, but the tall screen is 160 per acre. Once again, how many guys are ever even planting
an acre's worth of a screen, right?
Yeah, no doubt.
So I guess my question to that is, which I know we'll get, what kind of bagging sizes can we have these in? Can we ship these in? Is that to be determined?
You can. We are a custom seed shop. So if somebody wants to order a quarter acre of that or 3.2 acres of it, however they want,
yeah. We'll
put it in a bag and send it out to them. So
that's right.
We all keep all our boom. Inventory separate downstairs, as you guys noticed, in the warehouse there. So we come in and we mix things as they are ordered. That way we don't have 300 bags sitting around that John from Iowa ordered that doesn't work for, you know, Brett's property down in Arkansas. So we keep
made
that
to order.
Stuff.
It's kind of like McDonald's.
I'm just thinking here, you guys don't like deliver this and you're like pulling a dark parking lot with a little baggie and say, here you go.
Yeah.
Here's, here's your ounce.
Yeah.
It's prairie blend, dude.
Well, we're on the north side here. So some of that lingo slips in every now and then.
It's purple prairie clover, officer.
Yeah. Are you sure it's just powder? No, it's native seed. I'm telling you.
Yeah. They said it was really fine.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So going back to the prairie blend, phase one is there's a step process to get this. We have to get rid of the established species that are there. And a lot of times, if we're talking about converting a fescue pasture or some other area into this native blend, we have to take care of what's there first. And so that's where there are certain herbicides to help establish this.
Correct.
And we need to plant something that can withstand these herbicides to get the other the bad guys out so the good guys can grow. And so that's where we chose to go with this phase one blend of the prairie process to be big blue stem, little blue stem, and Indian grass. So hopefully that first year you're going to get some growth, probably not the head high, but who knows what can happen. We're looking to get something established that's beneficial. So we have these three species of grasses. And for the cattle guys, this is another thing that you can plant, and hopefully you may be able to even graze it that summer, depending on rainfall and site prep. So that's phase one. And that's where you could, I wouldn't advise it, but you could stop there and say, I got bedding in a bag right there. I've got three species. I'm going to have great grasses. And you, of course, you're going to have some other stuff fill in over time, but that's kind of the start of the prairie process.
That's a foundation.
That's
right.
It.
That gives you the structure and the cover that a lot of people are looking for. But again, what we want to do is look back at nature and say, how did it do it naturally? And that's where the phase two comes back in and adding additional grasses and adding forbs into this mixture to create a true prairie blend that's going to achieve incredible bedding.
To me, so phase one of the three grasses, big blue, little blue, Indian grass, you have 7 pounds of seed there, and it's $108 per acre. And
yep.
So a lot of times, I think we've all been guilty of this, me especially, of going and looking online at native seed and going, oh, it's only $48 a pound, okay. But then it requires 6 pounds per acre.
Right. I want to jump in too here and say that 7 pounds an acre is actually a pretty full stand for these native grasses. I mean, that's going to get you, that's pretty much right at USDA recommended for an acre of seed. But also at Pure Air Natives, we sell pure live seed. We do not sell bulk. You're going to get bulk because there's no way to separate some of that inert matter from some of the seed. But what we do is our seed comes in, we clean that seed, and then it's sent away for a seed test through a third-party lab that will come back and tell us our germination rate, our viability. So then we say, okay, if somebody brought in 100 pounds, viability is 95%. That gives us 95 pounds of pure live seed. We have 95 pounds, and that's what we sell. We don't consider that extra 5 in there, that bulk. So what you're looking at here is 7 pounds and a couple pounds of each species in this mix. That's pure live seed. That's seed that's been tested and will germinate by, you know, tested by a third-party lab. So there may be a little bit more in that bag, but you're getting actual live seed there.
There you go. Great, Perfect. Great explanation. Yep. So $108 per acre. To me, that's just so exciting because, shoot, we're how many times do you get asked this? How do I even go about establishing this? And then you may go and buy a 20-species mix and put it out there, and you start fighting weeds, and it's like, then you have to go out and do hand spraying and hand picking and hand pulling.
Another thing that we've done is we will also, I mean, like I said, this is a pretty full mix here, so that's going to cover most of your acreage there. It's going to help fight a lot of stuff because grasses are going to grow a little bit faster than forbs. But, you know, somebody can also, you can go in depending on the time of year, you can plant oats with that. You can plant winter wheat. You can plant an annual that's going to grow quicker. It's going to die off the next year, and it's going to shade out a lot of those undesired species and some of those weeds from coming back.
A companion
and,
crop.
Exactly. And we do that often with some of our contracting work that we do. So we'll put in oats. We did a lot of that earlier this year and go through it. And that just, you know, what you're doing with this phase one is somebody's coming in and saying, this year I want to plant something and I want to really take a big hold out of this non-native field. And my goal is to have a prairie at the end of this, but I can't do it all up front. Let's take a big foundation and start. And that's what the grasses is going to do in phase one.
There you go.
Love it.
So phase two is where it gets real exciting. And that's where we have high species mixes and other all kinds of stuff here that I really am excited about, because this is basically coming in the next year, the next dormant season, and planting the next one once you've taken care and got out all the other non-native perennials that are there. So in this mix, this is kind of where you really get to where you've got high diversity, adding forage and cover to the prairie, to the bedding area, whatever it is. With your first, we have a couple more grasses. You've got Eastern Gamma Grass, which is one of my favorites. Switchgrass. You notice I say one of my favorites on every one of these. Eastern Gamma Grass, Switchgrass, Side Oats Grama, Maximilian Sunflower, False Sunflower, Illinois Bundleflower, Gray Headed Coneflower, Marsh Blazing Star, another one of my favorites, Partridge Pea, and Upright Prairie Coneflower. To me, that's where you've got so many things in there providing benefits to so many different species. The Eastern Gamma Grass is one of those. It has a very unique seed head.
It does.
We have it growing kind of native in areas of my farm that you look at that seed compared to a little bitty rush where we were talking about almost like microscopic. Eastern Gamma Grass is one of those where it's like, it's like taking a turkey foot and plucking it off on each scale to where you're like, you have this big, gnarly-looking seed, and it kind of comes on a lot earlier than some of your big blue, little blue. It's starting to form clumpy bunch grass in a little bit earlier in the spring or in the summer to where it's going to provide probably more structure for the fawns and turkey poults early on while the others are getting established. Then you have switchgrass, the Sido's Grandma, and then you go into the sunflowers, then the bundleflowers, and the coneflowers, and what else can I say here?
Well, I think with the amount of time that we did on the preliminary of basically revealing these blends, hopefully encouraged people enough that said, okay, I get it. I understand. Yeah. I understand why all this
that's
is
your
here.
Prairie.
And this also helps with the whole sticker shock. You could buy the first one. You don't have to buy it all the same year. You buy it the first year, and you say, okay, maybe you go mow a few more yards or buck a few more bales of hay or whatever it is so you can buy the next phase two the next year.
Phase two could be 3 years down the road.
Yeah.
4 years down the road. You have a native grass stand that is going to be there year after year, and it's fighting back all this, you know, all these undesired species.
You can be spraying it with herbicide, making sure you have all these noxious weeds taken care of.
So if there's areas that you want to create bedding that have tons of open ground, you're like, well, I can't plant all of it, maintain its food plots. This right here, and you don't have a natural seed bed already, this right here is your go-to.
Yeah, and then you get this established. Oh, my gosh. And then if you want to add, I know you guys aren't a tree farm, but you love the land as much as we do. You want to add more diversity, you could add plum thickets or other woody species into these prairie things to where you have that diversity.
You never go home. You stay at your property the whole time.
That's Justin's going to bed down and down there, right. And they'll pray blends.
Just pull up my chair and sit down.
That's right.
That's right. I think, and you just all of a sudden there's going to be, you plant all that and you've got the native prairie, and pretty soon it's just like, holy cow. I've built an ecosystem by planting something.
Yeah. And you want to talk about achieving something and feeling something like of excitement. Yeah, it's certainly fun to it's attractive to plant food plots to see game come into them and take part of them. But like you're building and creating, I love the hashtag plant your legacy, but you're building, like I said, an ecosystem that not just one species is going to come to, but it starts from insects all the way up into mammals. And you take a huge part of that responsibility in planting that and managing a property in a native state.
There are no awards in land management. There are no Grammys. There are no Oscars. I guess you could win Conservationist of the Year or whatever. But really, there's no big award. The award that we look for is the award that Mother Nature approves what we've done. And the first day that once we get this established and we get our prairies, if you will, established, and the first bobolink that comes flying through, I'm going to probably wet myself with pure excitement of going, holy cow, I've never even seen a bobolink.
I might be able to find one and see if I can just get it to fly in front of me.
Yeah, a released bobolink. He comes out of the cage, a few feathers flying out. I'm going to say, there's something
the
wrong with that
thing. And
the
film crew comes out of the woods, get that shot. He's paying himself right now.
Yeah, that's right. And so that's what it's all about. And so I'm 100%. So excited. Before I forget, if you want information on these mixes and you're ready to order, when is the most popular time to order these species?
That is one thing I want to talk about. Planting dates for native species is completely opposite of what you know with row crops and any other flowers and things. Native species get planted in the fall, in the winter time, and then they will germinate in the spring and start to grow. So the official, I say official, unofficial planting date in the Missouri area is November 15th. Essentially, we're waiting for the dormant season, and then planting can start happening. Now, the majority of planting happens usually in January time, but people will start buying seed anywhere from now through March 15th is the last official day of planting season. But then if you're planting with a drill, you can get some leeway where you can get into May, and then even the warm season grasses can be towards the end of May a little bit. It really kind of, once you start getting on the fringes of those planting dates, really depends on the weather and the soil conditions.
Right? That's right. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So, but the heart of the planting season is going to be November 15th through March 15th.
And that to me is just like perfect timing. You're trying to wind down on hunting, or maybe you're just getting fired up, but kind of that winter time frame planting your natives. So you have something to plant even when you're not focused on traditionally planting.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that we will be doing an additional follow-up podcast on the proper establishment of how to get these things going and maintenance required to basically get these plots long-term benefit condition-wise,
so
ready to rock and roll.
To get in touch with Pure Air Natives to start ordering this and getting ready for the next window. Of course, there's people on staff to walk them through the process as well, I believe.
Absolutely.
That can kind of tell you, okay, what's the site look like right now, what you need to do to prepare for this. Of course, 636-357-6433, that's the number to reach Pure Air Natives.
And the office number, yes, sir.
That's right. And then you can email sales@pureairnatives.com and also visit pureairnatives.com. www.lacrossebrewing.com.
That's right.
So
we are we do not do online sales as of right now. We're trying to change that with the website, you know, as the changes come along there. But because we are a custom seed shop, you know, it's difficult to have online sales mm-hmm. when people don't necessarily know what they want.
Sure.
And so we like to talk to people on the phone, figure out what it is they need. You know, you guys have talked about it in the recent food plot podcast about what's the best thing to plant. Well, yeah. We get those phone calls too.
Exactly.
What should I plant? Well, There's a whole list of questions that we need to go over about your site and what's there before we can say, this is what you got. This is what you need. Now I know we've got these particular mixes here. You know, folks can call in and ask for that specifically. We know what's in it. It's not a problem. We can get that mixed up and get it sent out right away. But if there's something in there that you don't want, or there's something in there that you something not in there you want to add to it, or you just want to make your own mix altogether, we are a custom shop, so we're happy to talk to you on the phone and walk you through any of those questions you might have, and then get that seed bagged up and sent out to you.
Awesome. Justin, we thank you so much for coming on. Hopefully everybody enjoyed it. I know I sure enjoyed the heck out of it.
Yeah.
This is something that's near and dear to my heart, and I just love talking native grass, wildflowers, and the need to bring them back.
Bring the natives back.
That's it.
Well, I appreciate you guys coming out and joining me today and getting a look at some of the production plots, and thanks for having me on and being able to talk natives with me.
That's right.
Absolutely. All appreciate right. Justin.
Yeah. Take care.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Land and Legacy's Hunting and Habitat Management Podcast. If you like what you hear, check us out at landandlegacy.tv. You can submit a viewer question right there, and we're answering the podcast, or find us on Facebook and Instagram.
Feels pretty good knowing that from the beginning of time, God has called us to be a caretaker, gamekeeper, a manager of the land. So with that being said, don't you think we should do it all for the love of the land and the glory to God? Yeah.